Hello and welcome to Deloitte New Zealand's State of the State podcast series. I'm Dave Lovett, Deloitte's Public Sector Lead based in Wellington. In this short podcast series, we're looking at our 2018 State of the State Thought Leadership articles, exploring the topic of well-being in New Zealand. Each episode will feature our article authors and guests from across the public sector discussing why well-being is a hot topic right now, why it's important, and how we foster it from a number of angles, for the benefit of all Kiwis. In this episode, I'm joined by Deloitte partner Aditi Pandit, consultant Anne Molyneux, and Claire Falk, an independent contractor working across government. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Lovely to be here.
We're going to be talking about Article 4 in the series, Building New Zealand's Social Capital, a family-by-family approach, which reviews how we can build at-risk families' well-being to help them into security. You can read the whole article at deloitte.com/state of the state. So Aditi, what is a family-by-family approach?
A family-by-family approach is something we've seen around the world, and most notably we looked at an example in Denmark where a pilot's been running for 3 years. It's really the concept of looking at a family as a unit as opposed to a group of individuals, looking at the needs of that family in a holistic way, not just in terms of health or education or financial supports, but actually how do those things interact? And then putting a single plan and a single set of supporting services around that family to help them to do better. So it's really the big difference is that we don't no longer think about people as operating in bubbles as individuals. We understand the dynamic between the family. And as government, you don't look at them as recipients of just one service, but multiple services.
And Claire, what are the key changes that enable an approach like this to work for families?
I think all families and individuals look for a sense of trust when they work with individuals in government across, and often it's across a range of agencies, and there is often a stronger relationship that they'll have with one over the other, depending on who has the most interaction with them. And it's through developing those relationships that they feel that they can confidently address what their issues are. When they have to do that multiple times across a multiple fronts, it can become quite overwhelming, and ensuring they don't often know how to tell the story of what their needs are in a way that matches the questions that often government are asking for them. So the family by family idea is really around centering those decision rights as close to the individual as possible, but also ensure that we understand the complex needs that sit within the family.
And have you found in your work across government that this is an issue that comes up time and time again, that families and individuals have to share their stories several times to different agencies to find their way through the system to get the support that they need?
Yes, you do see that, and that conversation has been live for some time around the different needs that are required by a family and how it needs to be replayed across a range of fronts. And there have been approaches government has tried to address this, and some of them have been shown locally to be very successful. So it's when you see those great stories of families who have, with the right supports in the right places, been able to build their resilience to become more independent and understand what their needs are. And often there's such a complexity in there that they don't know themselves. So it is great to see it, to see those families turn around.
And Anne, so when these families lack resilience, what are some of the things that we see? What are some of the needs that we see expressed that a family-by-family approach can help to fulfil?
So one of the things about the family-by-family approach is that it's targeted to the most vulnerable families in our community. It's not intended to be a panacea for all families who are accessing government supports, but to be targeted to those who require an additional level of support. And when we look at the most vulnerable families in our community, the types of needs that they have are very complex and interdependent on each other. So take, for example, a family where the presenting issue may be that a child has been missing a lot of school lately. But what might may transpire when you actually dig deeper into that is that the reason is because the family doesn't have a car, so they're having to go on the bus to take the elderly carent to hospital appointments, which is meaning that they're having to find alternative care arrangements, which means that one of the children is taking care of the younger children, so that child is therefore missing school. So it's very easy when we look at our current structures of government to say, okay, so the issue here is that this child is missing school, how do we support this child to attend school? When you actually start to unravel the picture for that family, those needs are so much more complex, and under our current structures of government, it would be a range of different government agencies who are needing to come together to be able to meet the needs of that family as a collective. What the family by family model does is really cut through that in order to be able to say, okay, so we're going to treat this family as a family unit, look at all of those different needs as they layer upon each other, and then cut through the bureaucracy that means that that's currently dealt with by lots of different agencies by having a powerful navigator who is able to obtain the services and the supports that that family needs, given the circumstances at this particular point in time.
I think what's interesting in that is sometimes we can think those needs sound really complex, but actually the individual needs are not complex. It's just that they don't, as Claire said, don't present themselves in a way that the government agencies can make sense of. So what I find quite interesting about a family by family type approach is that in a way you return to some very basic human interactions, which is to actually sit down with a family and say, well, what's going on here? What do you really need? And it could be actually, we need some transport solutions. We need a way of getting to these appointments. So it's almost the complexity is coming about because multiple simple needs are not being met and helped with. And so they just compound and become harder and harder. Mm-hmm. So I think it's quite interesting that what government sees as complex might actually, in a community context or a family context, be quite straightforward to solve and might even be a cheaper solution than, you know, many of the big programs that we're trying to roll out at a cohort level.
And that's certainly what we saw with the Danish pilot that's been running. So they selected families to participate in that pilot on the basis of how much government money was being spent on services for those families. And they actually found that through this program, they saw a reduction in the amount of government spend on those families because there were so many different programs operating at odds with each other. Nobody had taken the time to actually sit down with the family, work out what was going to be the overarching set of supports that they needed and put those in place, which in many cases is far simpler and less complex than the myriad of programs and interventions that we see with many of these families today.
Mm. So what I'm hearing is that the family by family approach can lead to simplifying and focusing down on the things that those families really need. Are there things that stand in the way of moving forward with the family by family approach? Claire, are there complexities that lie in the way of making progress?
It depends on what the trigger is. And if we think of the example that Anne's given, what's keeping the child from school is issues around health and welfare of other parts of the family. Interacting with education is not necessarily going to be able to solve those issues. That might not be about a lever that they can actually address. So that's part of how you need to see the cohesive range of issues that are presenting and being able to ask the right questions to draw that out, because sometimes what's triggered it cannot actually be solved by the agency that it's presenting to.
Yeah,
I think that's really interesting as well, Claire, in terms of what question is being asked, and then when you hear about a problem that isn't in your domain, where does that go next? Mm-hmm. And I know we've heard that the best case managers and social workers and, you know, navigators that exist now, they don't only look in their own domain. So if someone says, actually my main problem is something else, they actually go, they use their personal relationships with other agencies and just make it happen. So it would be unfair to say that this is not happening in New Zealand. It absolutely is. It's just happening in spite of, rather than enabled by, our system of or our organisations.
Are there examples of where good progress is being made already? We've heard that, you know, there are case managers, for example, who go above and beyond thinking about some of the underlying needs particularly. Are there pilots or examples that you've seen that we can point to that are progressing well and having a real impact on families today?
I think there is a range of examples happening across government. This is something I think that is a well-discussed conversation across government. Wellbeing is important. People are identifying that often there is a range of complexity and they need to draw together as government departments to work on that. And you see pilots happening, and some in small and larger scale, where they're bringing together decision makers on to look at the complex issues that are presenting around individuals and families and how they can garner their resources to help. It's nationalising that in a way, I think, is the next big step, and understanding what's working well across all the different interventions that are happening now.
What's your view, Claire, on the sort of community development and community-led approaches? Because we've talked quite a bit about government needing to organise itself differently, but I know over the years you've seen some kind of different cycles around community-led change. What's your thought there?
We do see this happening at a community level across New Zealand with support from NGOs and not-for-profits, working really closely with individuals and families in a way to help them and support them to make their own decisions and build their resilience, which is fantastic. It's, again, it always comes down to how you nationalise that and who that should sit with. And it's, to some degree, there is a uniqueness in every community, so it's recognising that. There isn't a cookie-cutter approach to this, because there won't be for the families and the individuals you're working with. It's enabling the right conversations to happen that draw resources in around individuals in a way that actually lends support, but also backs away when it's no longer needed.
Anne, you talked about the Danish approach that's being used. Are there any barriers to introducing that kind of approach into New Zealand? Are there foundations to build on in terms of what's already happening here?
Yeah, so we look to the whānau ora model as being very similar in many respects to the Danish model. And in the New Zealand context, it would definitely be the right place to start in terms of building up the capabilities to be able to do this on a national level here. I think one of the key differences between whānau ora and the Danish model, and one of the real opportunities here, is to centralise the purchasing power with the navigator, who is someone drawn from that person's community, who can then make purchasing decisions on behalf of that individual. So through the family by family model and how we are looking at the way it could be introduced into New Zealand, that navigator would have the power to be able to work into agencies to obtain services, and would also have discretionary purchasing power to be able to buy things off the normal catalogue of government services as well. So you think about the way that ACC works, you've vested the purchasing power in the ACC case manager for anything relating to that person's accident or injury, so they can go out and that's created a whole market for private physiotherapy services, for example. So whānau ora should be no different, that navigator can purchase therapeutic interventions, for example, from the private sector if they're not able to access them through the public sector in a way that's timely.
Claire, you've highlighted a couple of things there, which is, you know, the need to be able to scale up from something which is, you know, quite an individualised approach. It still needs to meet the needs of individuals and families, but to be able to scale it up to something that can work nationally. But I think the other point there is that this isn't just a government thing. This is about government and communities and others working together. So it sounds like a system-level change might be required. What might bring about that system-level change? What might be some of the things that need to be different?
I think the challenge always is system in itself as a word can be a bit amorphous. What does that mean? And system level change is going to take time. as it would anywhere. So finding the balance between having some pilots and some examples that demonstrate success, and then really understanding what that would mean on a much larger scale, it's always a challenge, because there's the show the effectiveness, measure it, evaluate it, because you want to ensure that if you are lending support, you're doing it in the right way and that benefits can be realised from it. So I think it's a real challenge to actually enable large-scale change in a way that shows efficacy early.
I think the risk appetite and how you navigate that is such an interesting thing with these sorts of approaches, because it's almost like we don't weigh up the risk of the current state against the new approaches, and so we ignore the fact that there are actually multiple service failures that happen all the time and right now, and we then, you know, we kind of put that to one side, and then we evaluate the riskiness or not of doing different approaches as if we're in a zero risk environment currently. So I think quite a hard piece is you put new approaches forward, or you say, can we increase the purchasing power or the navigation power of this individual? And then the answer becomes, well, what if something goes wrong? What if there's fraud? What if there's risk created? And even one adverse incident can cause quite a ripple on an effect in the system.
Yeah, and it is a real tension that exists with government. You know, government has to be careful with public money, and ultimately it's a lot of public money which is being used to deliver these services. But government, sitting in a place where it can control that money, is often in the worst possible position to work out what the needs of the individuals are and how best to meet those. And it's that tension between the local decision-making and some sort of accountability and oversight that might give the government confidence to move down this path and put some of these models in place.
I think it's more how we bring those learnings together from these approaches that we've tried and really harness it. Because I think we're already on that pathway. The wellbeing conversation has been around for some time, bringing services together. So there are examples live right now across New Zealand of that happening and happening well. So it's how we take it further and support it to be successful.
And Anne, what lies beyond the family by family approach? So that's, I understand, that's just one component of the sets of services that need to be put in place in order to enhance resilience and well-being for families. What are some of the other things that we could consider?
So in the series that we've been looking at around family by family, we've looked at three key characteristics of families who the system is successful for at the moment. So the first of those is that they are able to navigate the system effectively to meet their needs. The second is that they have a level of discretionary purchasing power to be able to backfill where services aren't available. So, for example, paying to go and see a physio privately if you can't get timely access through the public system. And then the third is being able to have the self-confidence and the ability to advocate for oneself within the system. So being able to say, no, I do actually have a right to this, and push back against the system. So the family by family model only really, it addresses all three of those through the form of a navigator. But obviously, to build real resilience in communities, we want to vest as many of those attributes into the individuals as we can, and the individual families as we can. So we're also looking at models to say, how could we increase the amount of discretionary purchasing power that families have to be able to purchase the services that they can see that they need? And then also, how do we build that advocacy mindset so that, or change that dynamic so that families aren't in a position of feeling that they need to advocate for their needs and they need to have advocates who go in and do that for them, but that the system dynamics change, and that ties back to the community-led development approaches, so that that decision-making is much closer to the family, and there's no longer such a need to have such an advocacy mindset into how we access services from government.
So it sounds like a higher trust model as well between government and community and families would enable some of these things to happen more easily. Is that fair? Are we describing a higher trust model in future, or are there other changes that might be needed as well?
Part of the real challenge here is change of this complexity and of this size takes time and requires an organising vision that brings people together and is well developed enough that it can stay the course, but also respond to what it learns along the way. And that's not easy. And it's a rare thing to see the whole concept and the strategic intent at the beginning followed through in a way that has stayed true through to delivery. And allowing for people to come and go in that time, because that always happens. I mean, this isn't months, this is years that it will take, and you will see the key leadership roles change and the dynamics change. So how do you keep that organising vision and keep the buy-in all the way through, I think is a really complex complex challenge.
So it is a higher trust model going both ways, where government needs to recognise that families have an intention to do the best they can for themselves and to actually do well for their children, which is increasingly the case, as Claire said earlier, but also that families have the opportunity to build that trust that actually, if they tell their story, if they place their trust in services, that they won't be let down. And so at the moment, we have this environment where probably some of the adverse events then degrade that trust on both sides. So how do we move forward from that and recognise that we're all here for the same thing, which is to see, you know, future generations of New Zealand children doing better than the previous?
I think one of the dimensions that changes with this model is the concept of control, because under the current system, it's very easy to for government, which is quite can be quite disconnected from the communities that it's working in, to set policy settings that are about saying we know what's best for these communities and therefore these are the settings that we're going to apply into those communities. Whereas, as Aditi was saying, it's more about saying actually these families are the people who know their circumstances the best, and we should be trusting that they are therefore the best placed people to know what is going to work best for their families. So that government moves into more of a supporting and enabling role to facilitate that for families, rather than a much more of the old-fashioned sense of saying we know what's best and you just need to do these things that we've told you to do.
Mm. So when we're designing and implementing these services, then does it make sense then that families need to be involved in that process? So control is not just something that happens on a day-to-day basis when somebody else has designed the services, but actually some of their thinking, their needs, is baked in from the start by the community groups and government agencies that are involved in supporting these families.
So what this model represents in terms of the family by family, and some of the examples we're seeing across New Zealand now, is it brings to the table from both sides a multifaceted lens. So if we use the example that Anne gave about the child's not at school, but it's because of issues with health with other parts of the family, if that lens that doesn't see all the different parts of that families and coming from both sides, then it's going to be really hard to address the issues. So I think it's enabling, and what the family by family model does is put someone straight in with their family or individual that can see across all the elements, as opposed to this is the educational needs, these are the health needs, these are the justice needs, these are the housing needs. There is only so far you can take a conversation with an individual or a family if you're only coming up from one lens. It will never address the holistic nature of the problems. And sometimes, not always, it's not easy to articulate to the person that you're interacting with what all the problems are. So it's been enabling conversations to happen where decision rights sit, that you can see all of the presenting problems, and sometimes that will take time as well to uncover.
One of the things we've seen with the Danish model as well is that these families go from having plans with every single different agency that sets out the agency's goals for that family as they relate to their particular aspects of the system, to the family having a single plan that is based around their aspirations for what they want to achieve as a family, that is a single piece of paper that the family can stick on their fridge, and then all of the agencies are saying, well, we're here to support that particular plan. And I think that cuts through a lot of that as well, because it's saying we're working with you as a family to define what your aspirations are and to document them and then to give you the support to achieve those aspirations. We're not coming in here and saying, this is our housing aspiration for you, this is our justice aspiration for you, our educational aspiration for you as a family.
I think there's also an opportunity for the navigator to potentially be more of a coach for some families. So equally, some families can benefit from someone who can help them disentangle all the different things that are going on and actually figure out, well, what is the first thing to sort out here? Or is there actually a fundamental issue? For example, are we paying off debt on a hire purchase that is really, you know, taking a huge chunk out of our income? We just can't see that in amongst everything else that's going on. So I don't think we can be naive about the fact that, you know, some of these families do need help to actually understand what the first, second and third things are to be working on and how to sequence those. I guess it's creating the environment where you have a trusted friend who can help you with that and can then get you the supports as you identify those priorities, rather than hoping that through five or six different interactions somehow the family will come to that insight themselves.
So if people are interested in understanding what's happening today, can you maybe give some examples where there might be initiatives already happening that model some of these approaches?
There are some great examples alive and well across New Zealand. Some are government-led, some are community-led. I can think of, we have ISR pilots happening in the North and South Island. We have the Aviva approach in Canterbury. We have Whanaia place-based initiatives, many of them coming to the table with very similar themes and concepts about what we're trying to talk about today, around focusing around the needs of the family, whether it's been triggered either through a crisis event or through recognising the complexity of the needs around the individual.
I think a great example or set of examples to look at is also around iwi-led social services, where very often, because the iwi takes an approach which is not only addressing need but also building on strength of community and building for long-term success, they're able to be there for families and whānau through times of, you know, strength as well as vulnerability. So some fantastic approaches there.
Okay, I think that's all we have time for in this episode. Thanks again to our guests Claire Fogg, Anne Molyneux and Adithi Pandit. I do encourage you to check out the article we've discussed, and indeed the whole series, on our deloitte.co.nz website. And there will be a fuller article looking at family by family and other approaches, which is coming out shortly. Why not share your thoughts on what we discussed today and on well-being more generally with us on Twitter at DeloitteNZ or LinkedIn. Don't forget the hashtag StateOfTheStateNZ. Over the course of this podcast series, we'll be looking at well-being through a range of lenses, with the next episode looking at government's four capitals approach to well-being, in particular, human and social capital, and how we can practically build these for the benefit of all. Thanks for listening.